Hi there, it's Nick here. Thanks so much for your continued support of the Nick Luck Daily Podcast. Now, I know I've urged you on more than one occasion in the past to check out the racing app. And if you're a fan of US horse racing, as you know I am, never has this been more important, because the US service on the racing app is truly terrific. Not just the cards, very easily accessible for the day's racing, but also the video past performances, which are available completely free of charge, irrespective of any betting accounts, but also available at just one click. It's all there at your fingertips. If you are not resident in the United States and are a massive fan of American racing, this is the place you need to be. The Racing App. Download it today. You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis. By the Racehorse Owners Association. And by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares. Hi there, welcome to the show. Friday, March the 29th. Good Friday. I hope you're all enjoying a fabulous Easter weekend. I'm here in Dubai. The sun is beating down ahead of the Dubai World Cup. More of that in a few moments' time. We start, however, today by talking about Derek Fox, the Grand National winning rider, who heads back to Aintree in a couple of weeks' time to defend his crown aboard Corrock Rambler. And he has had a very, very lucky escape, because he has come within a hair's breadth of a whip suspension ruling him out of the Grand National, and there's a rather curious reason why he's avoided one. Marcus Townend from the Daily Mail broke this story, ran it as an exclusive in the Mail yesterday, and followed it up this morning. Marcus, what's happened?
Derek had a whip infringement, shall we say, at Newcastle on Tuesday on a horse called Clovis Boy, in what was a ride that had been lauded on social media, last to first ride. But the ride, he broke the rules. We don't know the exact details, but I think it's fair to assume that it was more simply than just going over the allowance of seven for in a jumps race. The ride was referred to the whip committee yesterday, and rather than handing down a penalty to Derek Fox, they have written to him to request further information. We do not know what that information is, but as a result of that, a decision on the situation has been deferred until Tuesday. Now, that means that any ban that Derek Fox then picks up as a result of that ride will not now kick in until after the Grand National. So, looking from the outside, some people might assume that a fudge situation has been sort of come along. That it would have been quite a sort of a big story if a whip ban had ruled Derek out of the Grand National, but because of the situation, maybe the BHA have looked upon him kindly. I don't know, but it's an interesting situation. The BHA say it's not an unusual one, but it's not one that we necessarily hear happening often, if at all. I've never heard of it really.
Marcus Townend, who broke that story in the Daily Mail. Lee Mottishead is the senior writer from the Racing Post. Lee, it's a slightly unusual one, for sure. Derek Fox by the skin of his teeth.
It does seem very strange, although the BHA was happy to be quoted through a spokesperson yesterday, stressing that this process, if you like, is outlined in the protocols and procedures around WRC meetings. I suppose an outsider might say, yes, it's fortuitous for Derek Fox, but it's also a pretty cumbersome way of reaching a decision. You'd imagine that it would be perfectly possible in these sort of circumstances for a whip review committee to get answers from a jockey in a much quicker way than this and reach a decision in a much quicker way. But Derek Fox won't be complaining, nor will Lucinda Russell, Peter Scudamore, or Corrock Rambler's owners, because this is a really significant moment. Derek Fox, of course, was almost out of last year's Grand National. He got back just in the nick of time after injury. On that occasion, Brian Hughes had been on standby. On this occasion, The Corrup Rambler team had indicated that they would have used one of their in-house jockeys, Stephen Mulqueen or Paddy Wadge, had been on standby for Corrup Rambler. That would have been a massive moment for either of those two. Instead, Derek Fox, a dual Grand National winning jockey, a jockey who is the only person ever to ride Corrup Rambler in a race, is set to be on the horse again. And if you look at the betting, Nick, I mean, it's amazing. He's 4-1 favourite now, basically, with all bookmakers. He has tremendous credentials, but bookmakers are pricing him accordingly.
All right, a slightly unusual byway then to start the show. Back onto the main highway now and headlong to World Cup night here in Dubai. The Gosdens are firing so many of their key horses at this fixture. The Stayer Trawlerman, the brilliant middle distance filly Emily Upjohn, Nashua, who's run in so many of the top races in the last 2 years. Great that she stays in training, and she'll be joined in the Dubai Turf by the horse who seeks a four-timer in that race, Lord North, who we've featured quite extensively on this podcast. Thady Gosden joined me a little earlier today. I began by asking him about Lord North and whether he still had that same inherent ability, even at his advanced age.
He still retains all the enthusiasm he's shown, and in his homework and over here, he's, you know, you wouldn't find much of a difference from the previous years at all.
So he still works just like the same horse. He's not shown any kind of loss of half a step in his work.
Not at all. No, if anything, he's shown more enthusiastic. He's obviously, he ran in the Winter Derby, which switched this year from Lingfield to Southall, which is a slightly different race to him. He obviously prefers a sharper mile and a quarter and a sort of slightly set of mile three. But he came out of that well. That's brought him on a lot. That's, he's of course a little rusty. I mean, off the track a long time beforehand, and it's race fit horses, but it's pulling him forward nicely, and he's travelled out here well.
I mean, as for Nashua, she's got a horrible draw out in stall 16. How do you think Holly is going to play that? And what have you discussed?
Well, like you said, Nick, of course, drawing 16-16's not the ideal position to be in. But fortunately, at Maidan, for the mile one start, it's a long run into the bend, so there'll be plenty of time for Holly to decide where she wants to put her in the field.
Mm. I mean, it's funny because she's often run good races held up. She's often run good races prominent or even making the running, as she did in the Prix de Diane a couple of years ago. What do you think is her ideal setup in a race?
Well, as you say, it's an interesting question. She's obviously a filly with a great deal of speed, and she can also relax in her inner field. And she's actually very versatile, which hopefully should help her on Saturday.
Okay. And as for Emily Upjohn, could it be that fresh is the best time to catch her? Is there anything in that theory?
Well, you know, of course, she won the coronation at the start of last year, the first run of the season. And, you know, she runs well fresh. And she's been drilled at home, really. She's trained well through the winter. Obviously, it's never easy getting fillies ready in the cold and the dark and the shorter days. But she's travelled out here well. Of course, first time travelling abroad. And she seems to be enjoying herself, really. She seems in very good order. And although, of course, it's a particularly difficult race. I think it was the second highest race in the world last year. And this year, the complexion doesn't look much different. Although, of course, fortunately, Equinox has retired to stud.
And a very big day for Kieran Schumach, getting the ride on Emily Upjohn and Trawlerman. We've discussed this quite a bit on the podcast. Thady, how confident are you that he can shine on what is a massive stage?
Well, yeah, you know, obviously, Kieran will be riding horses through the year. And hopefully he's got two good chances tomorrow and Saturday. You know, they're two very strong races, of course. But both horses deserve to be there. And they've both been training well into the race. He's an exceptionally talented rider. And he's very level-headed. And, you know, he's ridden plenty of good days before. He's well used to them by now.
All right, that was Thady Gosden. Lee is still with me. And that last question I asked Thady about Kieran Schumach was played with a neat forward defensive, but it doesn't seem at all equivocal now who is riding all the horses this year.
No, absolutely. I remember having a conversation with someone with relatively close links to the stable around a year ago now. And at that point, Kieran Schumach's name was already in the frame for this job. As you say, it looks as though from the bookings in Dubai that he is going to be the number one. Because lest we forget, Trawlerman received a vintage ride from Frankie Dettori in the long distance cup on Champions Day. It was a ride that received enormous plaudits, and rightly so. But the fact that Gosden's are putting Kieran Schumacher on him as well as Emily Upjohn, I think is a message of intent. And it makes this a big day for Kieran Schumacher. He is a super young jockey, but equally, he probably wouldn't have been necessarily the absolute obvious go-to man in these circumstances. It's a measure of how well he has come back from difficult times that he has impressed the operation enough for him to be the one they want to replace Frankie Dettori. And he has two chances to shine on a card where a lot of people, where I think, Nick, there are a number of people who are looking to make a big impression, James Doyle being one of them, on his first big international assignment for Wathen Racing.
And coming back from an injury as well, James Doyle, after a longish spell on the sidelines. As far as the Kieran Schumacher situation is concerned, I thought there was as much to read into it as regards the Frankie Dettori situation as there was Schumacher himself, given the fact that Dettori's sitting in the weighing room for the Shima Classic and can do 8 stone 5, never mind 8 stone 9, and 8 stone 9 is Schumacher's minimum weight. It's a pretty clear statement of intent. And I also feel that it is, not one in the eye is the wrong way of putting it, but it does rubbish the idea that Dettori is just going to be dotting backwards and forwards between America and England all season. I really don't think he is. I mean, yeah, sure, I could see him riding a few at Royal Ascot, but I don't think he's going to keep bopping back and forwards. I think he's made his bed now. He's decided where he wants to be, and I think that's where he's going to stay.
Yeah, and it's a lucrative sunny bed, Nick, so it's no wonder he wants to lie in it. And I think the conclusion that you've reached is perfectly reasonable. I think it would be a surprise if Frankie Dettori didn't come to Royal Ascot, not least because there will be a handful of high-class American horses there running at the meeting. I think there will be still some big decisions to be made by the Gosdens and their owners, particularly, I guess, with a horse like Inspiral, who, given Dettori's record on the mare, you would imagine, I think, that he would still be favourite to ride her should she run at Royal Ascot. But I think you're right, Nick. I don't think we can expect Frankie Dettori to be popping up on Lockinge Day at Newbury or the opening afternoon of Glorious Goodwood. Perhaps if there was a live candidate in a classic or a really top-notch Group 1, maybe. But he is now an American jockey, and he keeps stressing, doesn't he, that he is an American-based jockey.
And to that end, Frankie Dettori's book of rides on World Cup night is in the World Cup itself, Newgate for Bob Baffert, the horse aboard whom he won the big cap at Santa Anita. Single figure price, Newgate as well. A Bold Journey in the Golden Shaheen, each way shot for Bill Mott. He, of course, rides Lord North. He retains the partnership with a horse he's won 3 times on in Dubai. They could hardly jock him off that one. And Star of Mystery for Godolphin. Interesting to see if he could ride a World Cup night winner in the Royal Blue of Godolphin. Star of Mystery for Charlie Appleby. Riding that one because William Buick won't make the weight on Star of Mystery, down to 8 stone 5, the lean, mean Frankie Dettori. In that race, Star of Mystery will be taken on by the horse that was her conqueror last time, a very, very fast filly who has slightly come out of nowhere for William Knight, and is going to be ridden by Mikael Barcelona. She's called Frost at Dawn. I caught up with the trainer earlier today.
Yeah, she's slightly sort of come into under the radar, I suppose, in the fact that, you know, she came over here after just winning a novice at Chelmsford, and idea being to sort of, you know, have a couple of runs on the dirt with the hope that we might be good enough to run the UAE Guineas. But, you know, plans have obviously changed somewhat since she's been out here, and you know, she's thrived. And yeah, to say that I'll be running the Alcor Sprint on Dubai World Cup night back in December, I would have said you were crazy.
Yeah.
But it's been an interesting route into it.
Bred to be a dirt miler, and here you are as a turf sprinter.
Yeah, exactly. And as you say, that's what her pedigree sort of suggested. Well, you know, pedigree suggests she's a miler, really. But she's just shown a lot of speed in her races, and, you know, it was evident that certainly after a third start, when she finished behind, so Cinderella's Dream, and you know, she showed a lot of speed again that day. And you know, since we've dropped back to sort of 6 and 5 furlongs, you know, I think it's shown the best of her.
And yeah, 5 furlongs last time, she absolutely bolted up, beating Star of Mystery, who she reopposes. Are you actually now worried that she might not be effective over 6, and actually 5 is what she wants?
Well, yeah, you know what? She was so impressive that day, and I suppose if they beat her, you know, if they get a track record, then you sort of probably would rather stick at that trip. And yeah, it was, you know, beforehand going into it, it was a bit of a, you know, well, look, we'll throw the day. It was our only route into the Alcoz to run in that race, and it was a, you know, a bit of a surprise how well she ran. And certainly beating the track record was a massive surprise. So look, Mikhail got off her that day and felt that she would be better back at 6, but we'll see. I think we'll learn a lot more come Saturday.
And am I right in thinking that Mikhail Barzalona could have ridden Star of Mystery, the favourite, and has actually chosen to stay on your filly?
Probably no. I think the owner of Frost at Dawn was quite adamant that Mikhail would ride Frost at Dawn, and you know, fortunately he put his foot down, and we've got Mikhail. So
right, and of course he would have associations with the ownership of Star of Mystery. So they kind of, I guess, they sorted it out between them. Yeah,
I think they've sorted it out between themselves, and you know, look, it's great for us that we've got Mikhail riding her, because you know. He gave us such a nice ride the other day, and you know, it's just nice to come into the race with someone who's ridden her before as well. You know, Jim Crowley, who obviously did a good job on her as well beforehand, naturally wasn't going to be able to do the weight last time either. Certainly wouldn't have done the weight tomorrow night. So we're all delighted we've got Mikhail.
William Knight there, with so many countries competing on World Cup night, this could be an ideal time to play in the world pool. Let's hear the thoughts of Jamie Hart.
Hello, Nick. Yes, it's the Dubai World Cup, and of course it's an opportunity for people to get their teeth into those massive world pools where everybody around the world not only sends their best horses to Dubai to compete, but all of the punters around the world are competing in one big world pool, which means there's massive value on offer. There are runners from Japan, obviously. We've even got runners from Hong Kong in a couple of the races this year, so there will be big value again for UK punters punting against those fans in these big pools. Last year, if you had £10 on each of the 8 championship races, you would have, and back the winners, you'd have won just over £800 with the UK bookies prices. But if you'd had the exact same bets into the World Pool last year, you'd have won just under £1,300, so nearly £500 more just for betting into the World Pool against these Asian punters, rather than just betting on the bookies in Britain at British odds. So that's 66% more profit you'd have made just having the same bets on World Pool. It wasn't just because there was one big overpayer. 6 out of the 8 overpaid. The underpays were on Equinox, because the punters out in Asia love an Asian favourite, and obviously Equinox, you couldn't get a bigger favourite. And Lord North, because the Frankie factor, they do follow Frankie Dettori. Interestingly, Ryan Moore's 2 wins, both overpaid, and overpaid pretty well. Broome paid £14.20, only was 8-1 in the UK. And Sibelius, that he won on the Golden in the Golden Shaheen, was an 8-1 chance, that paid £9.80. So you can play Ryan Moore. They don't latch onto Ryan's rides as much as they do Frankie's. And the biggest value probably on offer in the Dubai World Cup meeting could be in the turf, because you've got a Japanese favourite in Dojuice. You've got Lord North, looking to do a repeat follow-up with the Frankie factor, and 2 Hong Kong runners in there. So if you're not backing any of those, there will be massive value in there. I'm a Luxembourg fan. I expect that probably to be the best bet on the World Pool this weekend.
Jamie Hart there, so much going on this Easter weekend. You'd be forgiven for missing the fact that Kempton on Easter Monday stage is a Class 4 restricted novice race, but it is actually quite significant because it's the first of one of those 100 qualifiers for the British EBF £100,000 two-year-old finals. There's one each for fillies run at Goodwood on the 25th of September, and one for colts and geldings run at York on the 11th of October. They're normal closing races, no forfeit stages and so forth. So if you want to enter or have a look at being eligible for one of those races, you need to be a two-year-old EBF eligible, placed in the first six in any restricted novice or maiden race run with EBF conditions. If you want to find out a bit more, ebfstallions.com. Now it's time for something for the weekend with Ben Linfoot from sportinglife.com. Ben, what do you got for me?
Yeah, obviously the Easter meeting at Fairy House culminated in the Irish National on Monday, but it's a good three-day meeting overall. A couple of horses on Saturday, Built by Ballymore, you remember, was very well punted in the Coral Cup at the Cheltenham Festival, went off an incredible 4-1 favourite against Langerdam that day. It didn't quite work out for him at Cheltenham, but Martin Brazel's got him in this novice handicap hurdle series final at Fairy House on Saturday, stepping up in trip to 3 miles for the first time. And he does look like a horse that will be suited by a severe test of stamina, I would say. He's still obviously very lightly raced. That was only his fifth run over hurdles at Cheltenham. So he's a dead interesting horse on Saturday. And also Comfort Zone, remember him? He won on Trials Day at Cheltenham back in 2023. That was the last time that we saw him over hurdles. He obviously ran a good race on the flat in the Patingo handicap at Leopardstown last September, but he is in a handicap hurdle, a listed handicap hurdle at Fairy House on Saturday, again ridden by JJ Slevin for Joseph O'Brien, and he's another fascinating contender on what's a really good three-day meeting.
So that's Saturday, Fairy House Racing Easter Monday as well. It's the Irish Grand National there. Desert Moor House has got to be amongst the leading fancies here for Martin Brassel, who also has Panda Boy running at Aintree. Before we come back, Ben, let's first of all head to Martin and have a listen to what he said about Desert Moor House to Dave Keener earlier in the week.
He didn't run over fences till he was eight. This fella the same. They're well mature and not over raced, really, over hurdles as well, because Desert Moor House was almost at the end of his six-year-old career when he won his first point-to-point, first time out.
3 miles five. It takes a fair bit of getting, so it's interesting to see how novices have such a good record in the race.
It is really, yeah, but like stamina isn't a problem with Desert Moor House. Like he was placed over 3 miles, won over 3 miles. I think the further he goes, the better he'll be.
Martin Brassel there. Ben Linfoot still with me. Ben, you're highlighting Dubai this weekend?
Well, the Shima Classic is a terrific race, isn't it? A mile and a half on the turf there. I was speaking to Richard Fye yesterday for his Sporting Life column. He's very excited about Spirit Dancer, who has been terrific on his international travels, obviously winning in Bahrain and then in Saudi last time. And it just shows you the depth of the race that this horse is considered a 20-1 chance, considering what he's done on his travels. The Son of Franco's been fantastic for Sir Alex Ferguson and connections. And Richard's really looking forward to him. He says because he's been out there, he's not been back to England. He hasn't needed to acclimatise. He's training really well. He thinks the step up in trip to a mile and a half for the first time will suit him. So he's an interesting outsider in that race, but there's such strength in depth with August Rodin, Emily Upjohn. It really is a fantastic renewal.
Ben Linfoot from sportinglife.com. Lee Motter said from the Racing Post is still with me. More stories in your newspaper, Lee, this week about the decline in betting turnover, whether prompted chiefly by affordability checks or not. It's a precipitous decline.
Oh, the numbers are big, Nick, and the numbers are worrying. Bill Barber, our industry editor, has been writing this week, as have other colleagues, about the latest stats that have come out from the Gambling Commission, which show the figures for online turnover on racing in the last financial year, 2022-2023. The number was 9.12 billion. That in itself represents a fall of around 900 million. But when you take into account what would have been the likely rise in turnover based on normal expectations linked to inflation, you can actually draw a conclusion that the fall was the equivalent of £1.75 billion, which is obviously a colossal sum of money. Interestingly, Nick, bookmakers' gross gambling yield, the profit in effect they have made from horse racing has been largely as one would have expected, that has risen, that hasn't really changed, which underlines that bookmakers have taken action in relation to the drop in turnover. They've looked at margins, they've looked at offers that are handed out to punters, and they have protected their own position, as one would naturally expect any commercial organisation to do. And in that sense, racing's levy return will have been protected, because the levy is now and in the future is set to be based on profits, not turnover. But for media rights income, this will have had a massive income. And Joe Somre-Smith, the BHA chair, was very quick to stress the seriousness of this and the likely link to affordability checks, which are not going away. They're not set to go away. We've still not heard as yet from the Gambling Commission in terms of a clear update to the likely journey of the government's plans through this year. We're waiting to hear about when the pilot will come in and other matters from the Gambling Commission. But this, one would imagine, would continue to place pressure on the government, because these are clear numbers that show what impact affordability checks are having on betting on horse racing, and therefore on horse racing's income. And one would hope that it's going to make it ever harder for the government not to take notice.
All right, well, we told you last week about the arrival of Elie Hinault as the new chief executive of France Gallo. Well, he's hit the ground running with a new incentive to try and bolster the horse population in France. You'd have thought there were quite a few horses in France, but apparently they need more. And Adrien Cugnas from Jour de Gallo is here to tell us why. What do you make of this initiative, Adrien?
I think it's interesting. I think it's a teamwork, because it's under the direction of Elieno to a certain extent, but it's also the work of the mission of Frank Walter, which was a freelance work on this particular subject. So the thing is that at the minute we have something like 8,500 horses in training in France, and the goal of France Gallo would be to have 10,000. Horses in training in a few years, like it was in the past. So they have a budget of something like 2.5 million dedicated to this new project, because, as you know, prize money is important, but that's not the only way to get new owners and to involve new people in the game. The recent years, when prize money have been increased in France, the effect was not immediate at all in terms of number of horses in training. So now they want to work on being more welcoming with owners, being more business friendly, and having all the paperwork more simple, make the life of owners much more simple. Because over the years, the forte of France never have been to be very good at giving a fun time at some racetracks for owners, because in some places we've been good, but too often in Paris, I would say it was not at the right level of how an owner should be received at the races. So I think they really want to work on that.
All right, Adrien, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The ever-reliable Adrien Cugnas from Jour de Gallo. Now, with one of the most welcome developments in British racing for many years, let's join Tom Stanley.
Nick, thank you. Britain's first ever Thoroughbred census has been released today. This work was commissioned by the Horse Welfare Board in partnership with Harborough University. And I'm joined by Dr. Jane Williams, the Associate Professor of Harborough University, and Dr. Barry Johnson, a retired veterinary practitioner who is now the independent chair of the Horse Welfare Board. Welcome along, both of you. Barry, first of all, I suppose the place to start is why did British horse racing need a census?
I think most problems start with a lack of traceability. And one of the most sensitive areas for the racing industry is what happens to horses after they leave the industry, when they cease racing. And so the ROR has been going now for about 20 years and done a fantastic job, but there's still huge gaps. where we didn't know where horses were or what they were doing or what lives they were leading, what their second careers were. And so this was as part of improving traceability generally within the industry. It was essential that we found out more about what happened to horses, particularly their first step out of racing.
And Jane, I'll come to you straight there. Do we now know a lot more? How has the census improved this knowledge of former racehorses?
I think it's really important to echo Barry's comments. You need to have a level of foundation knowledge to be able to build on going forward. So you can go back and see where you were and how the industry has developed its traceability. And what we've found is we can approximately now trace 80% of former racehorses. So that's any horse which has been involved in racing, not necessarily just in training. And there's about 5,500 of them, which are completely new to what we've already known through training of racehorses and across the discipline member body, so show jumping, dressage, etc. So we've got a lot more intelligence and a lot more insight into what people are doing with their horses, some of the barriers to passport regulation and to that ongoing traceability question.
And so, I mean, has this has obviously told us a lot more. Has it also told us that there are still gaps, Jane, and there are still a lot of steps to be made?
No, definitely. I mean, this is a good starting point, and it's really positive that Racing has worked with Hartbury as an independent body to undertake this research. I think in terms of some of the key lessons that we've got is we can start to understand perhaps some of the barriers for why people don't necessarily change horses' registration. But it's also shown us some of the really good news stories linked to former racehorses. So we understand a lot more about sort of the areas that they're going on to, their second careers, and the fact that actually a lot of horses potentially leave racing to go on to have really fulfilling second careers and long lives. We've got a real wide age range in the population. So I sort of expected there to be a normal sort of age range in horses. But we've got about a third of these horses that are over 15 years of age, showing the length and the longevity of them within their second careers, which is really pleasing to see.
Barry, with regards to the Horse Welfare Board, why is traceability that Jane talks of there, why is it such a priority?
Well, if you don't know where horses are or what's happening, then you're open to accusations that they're being abused or neglected. And in actual fact, what this has shown is that horses get a brilliant second life, largely due to the great work that's done by trainers and owners. When horses finish their racing career, they ensure that they either look after them themselves in retirement, or they ensure that they do get a good home and start a new second career. And the evidence is there to show that that has been working. There's always a few that escape the net.
And I guess moving forward, I'm assuming here, I might be completely wrong, is the onus on owners? Is it on the industry educating owners about when they do move on to tick every box passport wise to make sure that every horse is traceable? And do you think that owners are as aware of this as they need to be?
I think anybody who owns a horse, virtually any animal, is responsible for its welfare throughout its life. And so therefore it's important that if it's changing ownership, that notification is passed on to the new owner so that they recognise their responsibility. And that requires notification to Weatherbys so that the information is locked. And we're putting a lot of steps in place that hopefully we will have 100% traceability as horses leave racing. So as they leave the registered, the licensed part of it under a trainer, we'll know where they're going and what they're doing. A lot of horses go back home to their owners to be rested and then maybe come back into training or maybe go on as to brood mares or whatever. But the responsibility for the horse rests with the owner. Trainers often take the responsibility themselves, but owners ultimately are responsible for their horses.
So, Jane, to add to that as well.
Please do. Come in.
So one of the things that we learned from the census is actually there is a decent percentage of people who responded who weren't fully aware or perhaps didn't choose to answer some of the questions around changing passport registrations. And that does identify there is a piece of education to do for people. We also found out there's some barriers and the paper-based process, which is currently across all of the different equestrian areas, not just in racing, is one of them. So actually being able to also lobby from a policy perspective and to work with the wider bodies to be able to get a fully digital system probably is one of the biggest ways we could improve registration and traceability going forwards as well.
So we have our first ever thoroughbred census in Britain. I guess the question is, given that the work doesn't stop here, what's next? Either of you could answer that.
Well, lots more work. It's great. I think, as I say, this is a real good starting point, but a starting point is only as good as what you go on to do. And there's lots of initiatives being planned linked to the Horse Welfare Board. And also at some point in time to repeat this exercise, it might not look exactly the same, but I think it's really important that we do have another point where we can reflect and we can see what improvement has hopefully been made. But also, I mean, this can really link into strategy and link into education initiatives to be able to improve welfare for the horses. And I think, again, racing is in a really strong position. We've got good intelligence. We've got good support from the owners and from the trainers that we can really drive forward and make racing a key leader in this space.
Final thought, Barry?
Yeah, I think the thing about having people contacted, they become part of the retired racehorse community and they can receive benefits educationally and otherwise from that community going forwards. And I think people are pleased to be part of something where they can get help if they need it. And if somebody's in desperate help, then the ROR is in a position to step in and make sure that no horses suffer.
Barry, Jane, appreciate your time. Thanks ever so much.
It's a pleasure.
All right, Lee is still with me. Lee, before we go, a couple of bits of news from Australia. First, concerning Zaki, the real superstar for Annabelle Neesham, ex-Michael Stout trainee who put this trainer on the map. He's been retired after a brilliant career.
Yes, a brilliant career that became ever more brilliant in Australia. Nick, Zaki is almost the textbook example of the move to try and find listed Group 3 class horses in Britain or in Ireland and move them on to Australia in the hope that they can earn fortunes. And that is what Zaki did. He was bought by his Australian owners for 150,000 guineas out of Sir Michael Stout's stable. At that point, he probably won around 200 grand in earnings. He ends his career, Nick, in Australia, having won 4 Group 1 races and having amassed now career earnings of just over £6 million. He was a colossal success for Annabelle Neesham and his owners. He's like to stay with Annabelle Neesham because he's the sort of horse, she says, that would want to keep busy. He'd get bored if he wasn't doing something. But it's I think it's great that they've retired him at a point where they could see he was, I think in Annabelle's words, a length or so inferior to where he had been at the past. But as I say, Zaki, the textbook example of why Australian connections have been looking for horses in Britain.
And on the theme of Australia, William Haggis looking for yet another Group 1 success down under with a pretty unlikely hero in my book. And I don't care if the Group 1 races over a distance aren't quite as good as they are in the UK.
Yeah, this is, again, having just dished out praise to Annabelle Neesham, Nick, I think praise has to go to William Haggis, who we've seen in recent years is so good at spotting the sort of horses he wants to take out to Australia, and particularly the Sydney Autumn Carnival. He's been lucky in many ways this year because his likely challenge was reduced to just one horse, Post-Impressionist. But what an impact he's already made with that one horse. He won a Group 3 at Rosehill last Saturday. He returns this Saturday, now in open Group 1 company. This is a Group 1 conditions race, not one of the Australian Group 1 handicaps. And Post-Impressionist is around 11-8 favourite for the Kia Tancred Stakes. He's now in the ownership of Lloyd Williams, a name who listeners will know full well as an Australian racing legend, multiple winner of the Melbourne Cup, and he'll race for Lloyd Williams in the Tancred Stakes on Saturday. I say he's 11-8 favourite. And when you bear in mind, Nick, that two starts ago, when he won a race back in Britain, it was a good handicap at Haydock. It was a valuable handicap, but he raced off a mark of 93. That took his rating in Britain to 98. That 98 rated horse in Britain is now 11-8 favourite for the Group 1 Tancred Stakes at Rosehill on Saturday, with prize money well over 400 grand to the winner. Great placing by William Haggis.
Okay, and have you got a tip for me?
I have, and I'm going to stay in Australia, Nick. This time I am going to go 20 minutes early. I'm going to move from Sydney to Melbourne and tip a horse in the TAB Australian Cup on Saturday. It's a Group 1 that has been moved deeper into the autumn by the VRC. That has proved to be an inspired decision. They've got a cracking race on Saturday. It features a rematch between two old battling partners, Mr. Brightside and Pride of Jenny, but I think they could both get toppled by a Tissue, who won the big champion stakes when we were both there, Nick, at Flemington back in November. This has been what Australian racing participants like to call the grand final of this horse's campaign. They love a grand final over there. This is a Tissue's grand final, and I think it will be a winning grand final in the Australian Cup. Takes place at 5:15 British time on Saturday morning.
Great stuff. And our Australian coverage on this podcast is brought to you by OzHorse, the power of passion. Invest where racing matters. Enjoy that. Enjoy Dubai. Enjoy All Weather Finals Day. Enjoy the Irish Grand National Meeting. Wherever you are, just enjoy the sport. We'll see you after the weekend. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis. By the Racehorse Owners Association. And by the racing app in partnership with FitStairs.